Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest this morning is Mishna Wolf. She is a former model, a humorist, and a best-selling author. National best-selling book, I Am Down, is a memoir recalling her childhood growing up in an all-black Seattle neighborhood as a white girl being raised by her white father who yearned to be a brother himself while dating a string of sisters. Mishna and I will be discussing her memoir, I'm Down, a hilarious look at what it means to be black and white in America. Good morning, Mishna. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Love to have you on. You have a wonderful story. It's really funny, hilarious, but there's some serious times, and it's fairly inspirational too, so I'm really excited to have you on with us. Congratulations on being a best-selling author. I enjoyed reading your book. It has those various pictures that you had put in the book, which I thought was wonderful touch because it gave me a better visualization of your story.
Well, thank you. I mean, you don't always know what pictures feel like. They have their own sort of fantasy of what the story looks like, but mm-hmm. I decided to include them.
Whenever someone reads a book, especially like a memoir in this case, you're trying to visualize what that person is going through, the author that is. And so this helps tremendously as far as that goes. Well, what inspired you to write I Am Down?
Well, I mean, I had been a comic, you know, I wrote comedy and I would do these storytelling series where it was basically like essay writing, and you would get on stage and you'd read a story, and it was kind of like what The Moth does in this American Life. In fact, I did some of those sort of shows. But everyone would latch onto these stories about my family, you know. And more than anything I would ever write about, people would just be so into these stories about my family. And I just was so surprised because I didn't realize we were that abnormal, you know. I mean, I know that sounds funny, but my dad, I mean, like, I just thought, you know, oh, everyone has a dad who kind of thinks he's something like, I mean, for me, it was black, but I didn't realize it was that unusual until people just started laughing at me and also coming up to me and sharing a little bit about their childhood and how they sort of felt out of place wherever they grew up.
You mentioned your parents were mismatched from the get-go, so to speak. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say my dad is like a very kind of outgoing guy, and he always sort of thinks he's like the life of the party, and, you know, he was like a brother. I mean, he was like, I can't even explain it. He was like the dancing guy at all. He was like a disco guy, and he was like George Benson, Al Jarreau, Bill Cosby kind of guy. And my mom was, you know, very sensitive, very soft-spoken, very introverted, you know. I mean, it would not be surprising to hear on, like, a Merchant of Venice film. I mean, she was very, very delicate. And it just sort of, like, it sort of never really made sense to me.
They came from a different background, too, right? I mean, because your mom is from the East, and of course,
yes,
your dad
grew up in
the neighborhood. Yeah, and your dad practically grew up in Seattle, where you end up growing up. I guess that's a big difference in terms of personality and style and everything else.
Yeah, and he was a huge sports guy. I mean, that was part of what his whole community was about. I mean, he grew up in a neighborhood that became black when white people started moving out to the suburbs in the 70s and 80s and I think even the 60s, but it started becoming a black neighborhood because it was in the inner city. And he played sports and went to the local high school, so everyone he played sports with was black. So when I was growing up, all his friends were the guys he played sports with because they remembered him when he was so awesome. Like, he surrounded himself with guys that remember the, like, great touchdown he made when he was 17 or, you know.
Right. I mean, he was plugged in.
The three-pointer at the buzzer. Yeah,
right.
He was plugged in.
Yeah, he was plugged in to that society or a community, basically, because that's what we talk about. When we grow up, sometimes we don't realize, but we have a community that we grew up with, and we just plugged in, and everything was fine. That's the world to us, basically.
Yeah, and pretty much. And that was his world. And, you know, my mom did not really fit into that world.
Please share with us some of your camping experiences at the GSCC.
Okay. So I went to this place, this day camp. It was during the summer when my dad would work, called GSCC. And the reason we call it GSCC is because it has another name, but St. Martin's doesn't want to get sued. So I had to, I thought it was funny to change it to government-subsidized charity because it's so generic. It was like, what's the most generic thing I can call this? So that it's obvious I'm calling it something else, because if I called it what it is, everyone would know. And basically, we went there, and we were the only white kids there, my sister and I, and the kids seemed tough to me. I mean, they would sit around all day, and they would do what was called capping, and capping was basically where you busted on each other. So I would just walk in the room, and the first thing, people would walk by and just pick whatever the low-hanging fruit was. For me, it was being white, so that was the low-hanging fruit for me. And also my butt seemed to be incredibly flat. Like, people could not talk enough about how incredibly flat my white butt was. And so I would just sort of walk into a room, they'd be like, you know, your mama's so buck who she could eat corn on a cob through the fence. Or, you know, your butt's so flat, it looks like two saltine crackers that don't off the box. People would just do this to me all day long until I sort of put two and two together and sort of figured out how you did it. And, you know, I got pretty good at it. I got pretty good at capping. And, you know, that's what we did pretty much all summer. We just cap on each other. There was one guy, Jamal, that was like sort of the head guy. And I remember because he was nine, and he was the first nine-year-old I ever met with an earring. He was like a nine-year-old with an earring, and I was like, he's just our pop.
Well, I can picture it's a form of communication, because it's sort of like breaking the ice. You really don't know what to say, so you say something like that, and hoping that, you know, will engage you in some sort of a conversation. Of course, you did it right back to them, and so you guys would hanging out.
Yeah, and also sometimes the best defense is a good offense. So, you know, just walking up to someone and letting them know that they can't push you around.
Right.
You know, it's sort of like, oh, this is a person of status. She just insulted me. I should be nice to her.
That's wonderful. That's a very interesting analogy to what you just said. At what point did you become comfortable with your true identity among your white classmates? Because you went into a white school eventually.
Yeah.
You transferred into a white school. And I knew that based on your book, you had difficulty in adjusting to them. So now, at what point did you find comfortable?
You know, I never felt totally comfortable in either world. I mean, if truth be told, I was comfortable in some things in each. And I mean, I'm using the term white and black. And I also partially mean class. Do you know what I mean? Those were also differentiating factors. There were African American kids that went to my white school that were not going to hang out with me because I was too ghetto. You know what I mean? So those terms I'm using, there were also a couple, you know, white people in and around, you know, my circle in my neighborhood. And, you know, they were, you know, I mean, super duper poor and, you know, sort of disparaging. I remember there was this family that took in foster kids when they wanted to buy a new TV. So basically, I would say I never totally fit in with all elements of either culture, but I mean, I got the opportunity at some point to pick and choose, and that's really fantastic. It's like, you know, I fit in sort of at my school. I started to really fit in academically and enjoy the learning experience there, socially. I fit in with some elements of it, but not others.
At this point in your life, obviously, your parents got divorced. And any role played by your grandparents from either side of the family?
Well, that was the strange thing about my dad's family. And this is partially why my dad wound up getting so much custody of me, which is, you know, sort of the basis of the book is like, I mean, it's this point in my life where, you know, my dad is this guy who's sort of this groove-talking guy who thinks he's black, and my mom's sort of this more delicate woman who's sort of very sort of concerned liberal type, and I'm on my mom's hemstrings. I mean, I was really, like, close to her. I really was sort of a tender thing, and all of a sudden my dad's getting primary custody of us, and I'm thrust in with him and his world, and I'm forced to sort of acclimate to it instead of, you know, just sort of being able to hide behind my mom, which I could do up until then. So with his grandparents, what happened was they sort of were pretty, you know, ambivalent about how we were being brought up or this and that or the other thing until my dad and mom got divorced. And then they really rallied to my mm-hmm. dad's side and, mm-hmm. You know, sort of defended him, you know, tooth and nail against my mom sort of, you know, taking anything or, you know, getting full custody of us. So,
right.
You know, they were really sort of instrumental in the custody arrangement that we had. And also, you know, in my dad keeping the house and my mom being the one who moved out.
Obviously, during this time, too, on what my understanding is, when you live in such a close-knit community like that, and especially when your dad basically grew up with his neighbors and everyone else, so you, at one time, you mentioned in your book about uncles,
yeah.
Not necessarily the true uncles, but they are, because they are watching over you, the neighbors, all your dad's friends.
Yeah,
You're part of the community, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, I mean, everyone, all my dad's friends, we called my uncles. There was my Uncle mm-hmm. Mike, there was my Uncle Reggie, there was my Uncle Hayworth. There were a bunch of, you know, people we just called my uncles, and that was just,
right.
You know, normal. You know, this I would call my aunties. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really sort of did feel that way. They did, you know, they were the people that I learned things from and who taught me how to, they taught me how to play dominoes. They taught me how to, you know, count to 10. They taught me how to tie my shoes. I mean, mm-hmm. these were, you know, sort of the folks, you know, there were a bunch of black women in the neighborhood whose house I could eat at if I was hungry.
Mm-hmm.
So
it was a community. It was a true community in a sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, I never quite felt like I was all right.
Mm-hmm.
Even within it, even as a child, you know, and mm-hmm. not many people have any problems with a child. They're relatively cute. But
yeah.
even as a child, being the white child, I did, there were, you know, there were also people in the community that would look askance at me.
Right.
Sort of, you know, sort of look at me like, oh, there goes that white kid. It was a mixed bag, like any
kid. That's the reality. That's no doubt about it, because you were... you are white and you live in a black neighborhood, so that you can't change that. But the good news I look at is that you were raised in an equal opportunity upbringing to have a wonderful flavor of the black and white culture in some ways. To me, the things that you've learned that no one else could have taught you, in reading your book, one of the things that captured my attention was the time when you were talking about, you know, what a dollar added 50 cents to it, you get $1.50, versus it's true that your white friends knew about Shakespeare's and so forth, but you knew the practicality of life. You know about living
yeah.
on the streets. You're street smart.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I mean, I was definitely very street smart. I mean, that was mm-hmm. just part of the thing. In fact, when I first started the white school, one of the things I did was I would go to the corner store and I would get the penny candies and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought them to school in like a little carrying case, and I would sell them at like a 400% markup. At I mean, it was just kind of outlandish. I would charge
uh-huh.
like, I think at the time, like a little pack of Nalinators is about 10 cents, and I would mm-hmm. charge a dollar at school because no one was willing to leave school grounds. I'd walk off. I didn't care. I would just walk off, go to the store, get some candy, come back. But
uh-huh.
because it was a rule that you couldn't leave school grounds, none of the other kids would, and no one had access to candy except mm-hmm. through me. So,
mm-hmm.
and I remember my mom getting pretty upset because I was talking about sugar too much.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of found my candy case, and she said, "What's this?" And I was like, "This is a business."
That's wonderful. Well, in your book, you talk about everyone going through the process. Talk about your mom going through a process of her own. And we all know that because life is a journey. And, of course, your dad.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you in the sense that you're growing up being wonderfully flavored, you know, along the way. So can you describe to us what were the processes that your mom was going through, your dad, and you?
Well, I mean, I can try. My mom was getting out of... like an 11-year marriage to my father.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the whole process left her really wondering, you know, how she got to this place. I think divorce does that for a lot of people, where she was just like, you know, she was trying to unravel the puzzle of maybe like her dysfunctional upbringing and sort of what that left her with, and maybe some self-esteem issues and stuff. Because, you know, I can say for my mom, her relationship with my father was probably pretty disheartening and pretty, you know, I think it left her really confused.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, I think she was sort of like, you know, what did I do wrong? How did I get here? You know, who's right and who's wrong? She was not like the most, you know, confident person, and I wouldn't say she came to it with the most self-esteem in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then for my father, it was like he could now really embrace this Black identity, you know, now that he didn't have my mother in the way, sort of, to, you know, regulate, you know, what she thought was the right and the wrong way to live. So it was this period where she was sort of wandering around trying to fix herself, and he was sort of like finally able to fully live who he felt like he was. And, you know, and eventually that sort of mellowed out for him, and eventually, you know, she became a little bit more grounded and more stable and a little more involved. But in that period, that's what was going on.
Very, very interesting. And obviously your sister was so adaptable to everything that what was going on, I guess because of a, you know, age. In your case, your mind was just confused as far as...
Yeah, I mean, my sister just was... She was a second child, and I think the second children are sometimes a little more well-adjusted. I mean, generally speaking, people think of them as better adjusted. And she was younger when she sort of was around we were sort of first really thrust into the Black community. I mean, we were really thrust into it because we could no longer hide behind our mother. You know, and she was no longer bringing, you know, all her white friends to the party. So it was like sort of like a section had just been eliminated. It's not like all of a sudden we added this Black community, you know. It was like we always lived there, but it was just like now that was everything.
Mm-hmm.
And for her, it was just where she was born into, and she just, you know, she just took to making friends like it was nothing doing, you know. Mm-hmm. And she was the first to like have a little dance troupe and a little dance routine. She was the first to like learn to jump rope and to double dutch and to, you know, to play the games and do the things. And she was really, really adaptable at making friends. She was just, you know, she was not self-conscious. She didn't care whether or not people liked her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a story I tell in the beginning of the book that pretty much defines my sister. When they made a tree swing in front of our house, a bunch of the neighborhood kids, my dad put up the tree swing, and a bunch of neighborhood kids came over, and, you know, he put the tree swing up so people would come over and play with me, because he really wanted me to make friends with the kids in the neighborhood. And basically, they came over and just kicked me off the tree swing and took over the yard. And, you know, my sister was, I just remember looking over at my sister, and I desperately wanted to belong with these people, and some girl was trying to carry her or hug her,
mm-hmm.
and she just hit them,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it only made them beg her to let them carry her more, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? She was just like, mm-hmm. no, I don't want to, you know, she's like, please let me carry you. And I was just looking at this like going, how do people want to be, you're 3 years old. I mean, I think mm-hmm. maybe she was like 4 or 5 years old at the time or something like that. But it's amazing to me.
Do you think that she adapt because I guess a child at that age just sort of absorb what she sees too. And so
yeah,
she,
I think so too.
Yeah, she assimilate the style, the technique. Like, for example, like coming back to capping, obviously you found, hey, this is a way to communicate, and it's no harm done kind of thing, you know, you have a
yeah.
good time.
And it was clearly a skill that you could work on, you know. Mm-hmm. Not everything is. It was like one of those things. It was like capping is like, if I learn enough of these buffs and I practice being really fearless in delivering them,
right.
I'm gonna have some friends and people are gonna think I'm excellent. And
right.
that was like a goal and something that was easily attained. It was not vague, it was not, you know, whatever. It was like easily attainable. It's like, if I learn to do this thing, people will like me. I'm going to learn to do this thing.
Right.
You know, other things weren't that cut and dry. And for whatever reason, I just got used to just talking like these kids talk.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a natural because you were trying to communicate with them and you find that that's the best way to cut through the chase and get to the point. And likewise, they're able to communicate with you and having a great time. So in that culture at that time, there's nothing wrong with it. Because,
no,
I mean, the greater the insult in some ways that you can throw at someone, it's a leg up, I guess. You get a certain amount of respect with it, I presume.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And respect is kind of the name of the game with my peer group.
Your dad, he went through a series of relationships. How did that affect you and your sister?
It's interesting you asked about that. There were a lot of black women that my father dated. There was a string of one after the next. And, you know, it was difficult in some ways and wonderful in other ways. I mean, these women, in some ways, having a lot of women in your life, they fill all the spaces that you sort of need as a woman coming of age. I mean, there were certain things that my mother was not, that some of these women did have for me, like answers, like, especially around things like, you know, becoming a woman and femininity and heels and makeup and all that sort of stuff. Like, I never would have, my mom is a little bit more crunchy and rare, but she was more of a hippie.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was like, it was really interesting because they filled, you know, sort of like, those things weren't so mysterious to me. They filled this sort of role that made them accessible. Like, oh yeah, you can just put on a little lipstick. Like, here's how you do it. This is what color, you know? And in particular, I'm thinking of Dominique and Yvonne, but you know, at the same time, I would get kind of invested in these women and it was really, really, I didn't understand that they could just be dumped and traded out regardless of my relationship with them. You know, I just could not understand that their primary interest was in my father, and when that was no longer a relationship, they weren't going to come back and take me to Disneyland. Do you know what I mean?
It
just didn't make sense to me because I thought we were like so close. So I mean, that was very confusing at the time, but you know, they were all really colorful, interesting women. The first, Dominique, was she was like this really kind of pretty and you know, spirited black woman who always told us she didn't like kids. But it's funny, she never had any kids, but you know, we were always kind of like, in a weird way, I felt closer to her because she didn't want kids, she wasn't having kids. And I felt like sort of like we were the kids that sort of passed. Do you know what I mean? Like, I felt special because we were the kids that sort of passed.
You
even
made the grade,
like,
yeah.
We made the grade. Like, we were in. Even if it was, like, on a probationary period because we were kids and she didn't like kids. And she and I wound up having a little problem in that, you know, she had some opinions of me that, you know, my dad didn't really dissuade her of. And, you know, and that's in the book. It was a pretty harsh moment that I had with her. And my dad was really kind of eager to belong with people. So sometimes he didn't always stick up for my sister and me when he maybe should have.
He was just trying to do the best of both worlds, I guess, in the way he's fitting in. I can see that throughout the whole book that he was just trying to fit in some ways also.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when you're a kid, you don't realize it's like my parents trying to fit in. Like, you could never imagine that they weren't king of the neighborhood. Like, I could never imagine that my dad was working at fitting in. You know, you can see it as a reader. I mean, when you're reading the book, it's like, it's from my perspective. So I don't really see that. But as a reader, it's like, it's very clear that, you know, oh, this guy's really working at it.
Right.
And he's pretty desperate to get these people to like him.
Are you a little bit of a mystic like Yvonne taught you?
Am I a little bit of a mystic? A mystique? Yeah. I would say I'm not. But, you know, I think some of my girlfriends might say I am. I would say I'm not really, but, you know, I don't know. I think ultimately, maybe I am a little bit. Maybe I am a little bit. I think I rebelled against everything anyone ever taught me at some point or another and then sort of accepted the parts that were usable. So in case people are listening and they don't know what he's talking about, I had a stepmother. This is one of my dad's women named Yvonne, and Yvonne was this really beautiful, very, very young black woman who taught me and my sister everything there was to know about feminine mystique in her own way. And she was very sort of, she had all these like taboos and rules around being a woman that were really kind of at the time interesting, and not all of them were accurate, and you know, it was, at the time, it was like, I couldn't believe it, but I had to admit, she was a very powerful presence in my life, a powerful presence in our home, and everyone sort of worked to please her. So, you know, I had to admit there was something to this mystique thing she seemed to have.
It's just a wonderful term, and when I read in the book, it's very interesting because it's something that sometimes we take for granted, because as we go through the age of innocence, we don't realize that we can be vulnerable too. And I think in some ways what she's teaching you is not to be vulnerable.
Yeah, and she really thought she was doing me the biggest favor in the whole world, me and my sister. I mean, I think she was like, she saw that at some point we were going to have this, you know, this this looming power on the horizon, which was going to be our adolescence. And, you know, she wanted to put the reins in our hands in whatever way she could, you know.
Right.
I mean, at the time she was, because neither of us were even close to puberty yet. I mean, I don't think anyone could have imagined what a late bloomer I would be. What she actually did was kind of traumatize us with all this. I mean, it was actually like some of the stuff, like when she was talking about relationships and this and that, and even sometimes she'd talk about sex stuff, it was like, oh my, like it was traumatic, you know? It was like, oh my God. In whatever way, you know, she really thought she was helping. And, you know, it was, she was just another one of the sort of mother figures that I had in my life through my father that was like.
Your dad was very, to a lack of a better term, that macho side, the manly side. And she balances the equation being the feminine side. You know, hey, girls, I need to teach you ladies to be. And that's what she used. She called you, y'all, both of you ladies. And she's trying to teach you that, right? She's trying to teach you that about, based on her knowledge, on how the other side of the equation works to balance it.
But I mean, she had really dogmatic things. Like she would she would tell us a man should never see your panties anywhere except on your body. Like if they see them in a drawer or in the washing machine, that they like lose their power. So you have to sort of hide your panties until you're wearing them. So it was like, we were like 11 or 12 and 8. So, you know, it's like we're running around hiding our panties from who? I have no idea. And there were just a million things that she was like, virgins can't wear tampons. So there was like this whole thing about like that. And it's like, I don't know where she, I don't know where or what that is, but it was just a million like little things that she had. I mean, I think there was like something about like trashy clothes or something giving you a yeast infection. I mean, it was just like a million like weird sort of, it was like, I equated to it was like learning about sexuality from the mom in Carrie.
Right.
It was really like that, but it was a mix of hilarious and like so intriguing to be around her all the time.
Well, she taught you guys based on what she probably would thought by her mom along the way. And with the flip side of it, on your dad's side, or certainly your dad in this case, he's trying to enroll you to every athletic club he could think of.
Right. Yeah. And trying to, yeah, which is like the opposite of everything she was teaching me. I mean, she's teaching me to like keep secrets and, you know, never betray your mystique and, you know, always keep things as a woman, you know, a little lie's okay here and there. It's about always keeping things close to your chest. And my dad, on the other hand, was trying to teach us to, like, be aggressive, be aggressive, B-E-A-G-G-R-E-S-S-I-V-E, you know? So it was like, you know, it was like this total, like, mismatch of messages. And, you know, it was about this time I sort of, I mean, if you, in the book, you sort of realize it gets, before it's pretty cut and dry, like, if I do this thing, then I will be loved and appreciated and accepted.
Right.
At this point, things get really kind of, they sort of start to spin out and the wheels are starting to come off.
Well, I think he appreciates also the fact that the women that he had dated has helped you ladies grow up having that touch of the feminine side. Because I think, obviously, even though you spend the weekends with your mom, he didn't put a whole lot of credibility towards your mom's side, but he certainly hoped that the women he surrounded himself with would kind of pick up the slack, being that he's a guy, that macho guy, ex-football player. He is hoping that these ladies in his life would teach you girls the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I also think he thought if we grew up sort of poised and pretty and, you know, wore heels and makeup and all that stuff, that it would reflect well on him at the end of the day.
Right. He's a complete person, a dad, that's able to accomplish all
he
that.
He sort of was hoping that when we weren't making three-pointers at the buzzer, that we were, you know, having debutante-type teas or, you know, I don't know what, but.
Is having a cake and eat it too. Hey, my girls are tough, but yet they are all women there.
Yeah, I think that was it.
That's wonderful. Tell us some of the happiest moment that you remember about growing up.
Well, I mean, I think the happiest moments were just sort of palling around with the neighborhood kids. And there were a lot of kids I really, really enjoyed there. I mean, Zuina was like someone who was really close to me. And I think the thing I remember us doing that was the most fun was like we would write like song parodies and sing them. Like there were all these different like song parodies we would make. And we wrote this, we did this thing where she told me how to take a cassette tape that I checked out from the library, and you could put a piece of wadded up piece of paper in the side of it and record over it, even the kind that you couldn't record over. So we had checked out this tape from the library that was like my favorite story for whatever reason. It was the story of Ping, and Ping was like a duck that lived on the Yangtze River. And so we would sit there and we would record over like the narration from the library. And it was like totally vandalism at the time, but it was so much fun to me. And like, it was like, we thought we were the funniest people. So it would be like, this is the story of Ping. And we'd be like, this ain't no story of Ping. And everyone, and so throughout the tape, it's like, it would be like, you know, Ping had 10 brothers and sisters. Then we get out, why Ping have so many kids? Or brother, I mean, why do ducks have so many kids? I mean, it was just like, and we just thought we had made the best comedy album that had ever been created in the entire world. I must have been like 5 or 6. And you know, the other thing, and we would get people's old tires. We'd get all the old inner tubes from tires, and we'd patch them up, and we'd go down to the lake. There was like a lake not far from our neighborhood. Get someone to take us down there with these inner tubes. And, you know, we just had a really, really gay old time a lot of the time. But, you know, growing up, I think my fondest memories were always trying to make each other laugh, you know. We did a lot of sketches, too, where, you know, I remember, you know, nothing was that particularly unique or funny or whatever, but I remember we'd do this sketch where, you know, whoever was eating something, the rest of the group would say what you were eating, and we try and make it sound like the grossest thing in the entire world, and then you sort of mock out how much you're enjoying the bowl of eyeballs, or, you know. You know, we were always sort of clowning around, and it was a really good time.
What I saw in the book is that even though your dad were going through a series of relationships, and the fact that, of course, I guess in this case, your mom were living on the other side of town or whatever, that your friendship with all your friends were intact, whether it's school friends and even with your friends in the neighborhood. And I think that helps tremendously, because that gives you whatever that support that you need when that alone time comes.
Yeah, and I mean, it's funny because I already see it with my daughter. It's like she's 6 months old, and, you know, she hangs out a lot with me, and she hangs out a lot with her dad, and she hangs out a lot with the, you know, one caregiver that comes over sometimes and helps out. And I'm starting to see, like, she's only 6 months old, but I'm like, oh, she needs a peer group now. She's sort of starting to want to interact with other babies, and it's really interesting how it just happens automatically, but she's happier with babies than she is with me and her dad, because with me and her dad, she's like kind of trying to get approval and attention all the time. You know what I mean? And that's sort of the goal. But with kids her own age, she looks like relaxed and excited to connect and, you know, all these wonderful things. And she's 6 months old. I'm like, boy, oh boy, you know, it's like, I really like, I want to, you know, I want to get her, you know, it's like, oh boy, it's time to get into a real baby group.
Your parenting skills, your motherly parenting skills, where do you draw that from?
I just try and give her what I would have wanted for myself, I think. You know, if there's something I feel like, if I was her right now, what would I want? You know, and I try and constantly reassure her, because that's probably what I wanted when I was younger, is, you know, a little more, you know, just a regular reassurance. I mean, I somehow I sort of believe security is the name of the game. So I want her to feel really secure that I'm always going to be here, and, you know, that she can make mistakes and she can fail at things and she can, you know, act a fool and she can, you know, do whatever. But, you know, that, you know, that I'm a given, that I'm, you know, my love and being here and loving her is a given regardless of how she acts.
Okay.
And then from there, there's like, there's parenting and disciplining and stuff like that. But fortunately, I'm not really at that stage yet. You know,
right.
I definitely, you know, I set limits with her already a little bit, you know, even as a 6-month-old. Loving limits, I think, is my philosophy.
Wonderful. And are the grandparents involved? Of course, it's still too young.
My dad, and my mom, both are really involved with her, and, you know, they're pretty proud grandparents. It's their first grandchild, so, you know, I mean, and they've gotten to a point, you know, in their lives or whatever. I mean, I think if it was, like, the time of the book and, you know, and they were those same people, I would never leave them alone with my child. But, you know, like I said, the book is a snapshot of a period where we were all going through a huge process of, you know, sort of getting to where we are now, and, you know, it was not pretty.
I think there were a lot of lessons learned along the way going through the process. What were some of the challenging moments that you remember?
You know, I remember, I think the most challenging moments for me were being left out of something because I was white and I didn't understand what I had done, or I didn't understand, you know, why I was being excluded. And it happened a couple times with, like, friends' parents where it was just like, you can't play with her. And just being sort of barked at in that way. I remember being barked at that way by someone's mom. It's like, you can't play with her. Just literally being told that about someone who I was playing with in the street.
Right.
And I just remember walking home, like, not getting it at all. Like, not knowing what was wrong with me and sort of walking home and internalizing this stuff. Like, why, what is wrong with me? Why can't I play with the pretty girl, you know? Why can't we play hopscotch?
Right.
And not getting that there was a context for that kind of thing, and not getting that adults can be wrong sometimes.
Well, to me, that's, of course, that's the adult's perspective, because kids, you don't look at it that way. You're looking at everything as being equal. When reading your book, I got the basketball gave you a sense of self-esteem. Self-confidence. I thought that was something very, very important in your life that you did. However, I think swimming really helps you to define your purpose. And one of the things that I really like, what your coach told you, I'm going to read this real quick. A winner is someone who finds that absolute limit of a person's agony and suppresses them every day. Tell us about that.
He had this saying, and it's actually, it's like, a winner is someone who finds the limits of personal agony and surpasses them every day. And that's what he would always point to on the board when we were tired, when we were feeling hurt, when we were this, when we were that. And, you know, I think that for like an 11 or 12-year-old, the message was a little bit extreme, you know? I mean, I think I was about 11, 12 maybe when I started swimming on that team. And, you know, talking about surpassing personal agony to an 11-year-old is kind of, you know, it's kind of crazy and hilarious. But it did sort of, you know, and he was sort of an extreme funny personality who he did, you know, he did sort of, it didn't, it was like being a Marine or something like that. You know, it was like all of a sudden I went from being this junkyard scrapper to sort of being part of something that I took very seriously and that was taken very seriously. And just to be a part of something serious at that point in my life, it did give me some self-esteem, for sure, for sure. And also with the basketball, the thing that gave me self-esteem there is that it wasn't that, you know, I was on this, just to let people know, I was on this basketball team in Seattle called the Satin Dolls, and the team was unbelievable. It was all these 6-foot black girls and me. There were like 6 6-foot black girls and me. And we would go into white community centers and we would literally win like 79-0. And we were 11 years old. So it would be like these ridiculous, these girls were so good. It was like watching lightning or something like that. We would run circles around the other team. And it was indescribable to be a part of this group of girls. You know, and at the time I was really bumming out that I had to be on this great team where I was just this liability all the time. But, you know, I had these wonderful black girls never made me feel that way. They always mm-hmm. wanted me to get better at playing. You know, mm-hmm. their goal was always for me to get a little better.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so generous, you know, just like, you're here to play, you should play. Make more rebounds, you know, why don't you take a shot or two? Mm-hmm. And I was just trying to not screw up, you know, because I didn't want to take their championship away. But, you know, there was nothing I could do to mess these girls up. They were so good.
You dedicated the book to your mom and dad because they gave mm-hmm. you the best childhood you would never have been smart enough to ask for. What do you mean by that?
I just mean, like, if I was to talk about the perfect childhood, if I was to ask for the perfect childhood, I think I would have chosen something with no challenges in it. And instead, I got this childhood that, you know, trust me, I realized, you know, the race relations and fitting in and stuff like that, they're the stuff that a coming-of-age story is made out of. They're the stuff we all relate to because everyone sort of feels like a misfit in adolescence at some point or another. But, you know, I never would have thought to ask for the challenges. And it's the challenges at the end of the day that make me who I am today. And it's the diversity of the upbringing that was so challenging that has also sort of, you know, become who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like I'm at a place in my life where it's like I'm really grateful for who I am. And I really enjoy being that person. So, you know, it's like everything my parents did got me to this place.
And whether it's by design or just by going with the flow, it just happens because life is living and you are just absorbing what was thrown at you. And then you realize, voila, now you could apply whatever you've learned for your own
personal
success.
Yeah, and they put things in my life that I had to transcend in order to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to, you know, it's like if I hadn't had to transcend, if weren't things so difficult that I had to overcome them, you know, and just, mm-hmm. and even in things with my self-esteem and, you know, things, I mean, I know I've heard that word around and nobody ever really knows what it means, but, you know, my own sense of confidence, feelings that I brought out of that in the neighborhood about just in the back of my head, feeling like not good enough or like there was something wrong with me. If I hadn't had to really look at those things and examine them and hold them up to the light and say, you know, why do I feel this way? What is this thing? You know, what's dragging me down here? And why am I not sort of soaring? Why am I not soaring when, you know, it seems like everything around me says I should be? And I had to look at this stuff. It made me a happier person at the end of the day. And it made me a more sympathetic and empathetic person. And that's really, you know, the big gain from my upbringing is that I got to come out of it with being able to see a lot of different sides mm-hmm. of things.
Very true. How does your dad react to the book?
You know, my dad's very proud of me. We're very close. He's mm-hmm. a big fan of the book. He says when he reads it, he's like, you know, everyone could tell I love you and everyone could tell you love me. So that's what matters.
Very true. You know, very true. I have to agree with that because whatever he did, I mean, we all live our lives accordingly, but there's a lot of love in the book. And
yeah.
he loves you the best way he knows how, and so did your mom love you
yeah.
the best way she knows how.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everyone makes mistakes, and there's a lot of really wonderful and hilarious mistakes in the book. But I think that does come across, and, you know, and at the end of the day, he's super proud that, you know, his daughter wrote a book and that, you know, it's done so well, and he thinks it's really well written, and he thinks the message is really great, and he's, you know, he in a weird way, it feels redemptive to him, I think, you know, it's like he's got to be a part of something that has brought a lot of joy and laughter and clarity to a bunch of people's lives.
How has writing the book impacted your life personally?
Oh, it's changed my whole life. I mean, I have to say it's been like this great thing. I mean, when I first got the book deal, I was separated. Mm-hmm. And it was like, and I it was someone I met when I was really young, and mm-hmm. I just was like really not sure about writing a book. I didn't know. I had been like sort of a housewife for quite a few years, and
mm-hmm.
I was not very confident. I was in a place where, you know, it was not a great relationship for me in a lot of ways, and it really affected my self-confidence and my belief in myself. And, you know, I was in a pretty dark place, I think. And I just sort of wrote my way out of it. And, you know, and I wrote this book and I was just like, I'm just going to put it on the page. And I had to relive my childhood in order to write the book. And it was very difficult at times, especially because I was going through a hard time in my personal life to be reliving the childhood. And, I just kept writing and I kept writing and I kept writing. And I just, sometimes I would have like a, I would just sit at my computer and cry and write. And I was just not worried about it. I just wrote no matter what. And, not because of the book necessarily, but also because of things that were going on in my personal life that paralleled my childhood a little bit. And I just kept writing and then I turned the book in and I wasn't sure about it because you put something out in the world and you're not sure how it's going to be received, if anyone else is going to relate to it, or whether or not people are going to hate you for talking about race the way I did, or whether or not, you know, your family's ever going to invite you to Thanksgiving again. And, you know, and I put it out there and I gave it to my sister, my mom, and my dad to read. And I told them that I'd be willing to change, you know, it. I said, I'm open to hearing their comments if they think I didn't get something right or if they feel like I got something inaccurate. I said, I won't necessarily change it, but I'm open to it. You know, I'm open to hearing it. I'm open to it. And I, the first person who got back to me was my sister, and she was like, you are so dead on. This is so my experience. And just something about that, it was just this, like, sigh of relief. Like, it was just like, like, okay. And I really felt like part of a family again, because I sort of felt like I was on the outs of it for a while. And then, you know, I gave it to my editors and everyone loved it. And then it started, the reviews started to come in and they were great. And I never would have expected it. And it gave me so much confidence in myself as a writer, as a storyteller, you know, as all these things. And then people started reading the book, real actual people. And they started to write to me and they started to tell me about their childhoods and how much they related to my book. And it made me feel so a part of, in so many ways, you know, like I felt like part of this whole, I feel a part of this whole community of people now that have had sort of similar experiences growing up. And it's been amazing, you know, even just to hear, just to have someone share what their childhood was with me is such a gift. I can't even say.
Your book is a wonderful book, and it certainly made me realize when I was growing up the things that I went through and so forth. And as I mentioned earlier, it's a journey that we all take, and there's no really right or wrong. It's just lessons learned, and what we went through made us who we are today. And so that's the beauty of your book. When you talk about race, when you talk about sensitive issues, whether it's religion, race, and whatever, unless you live in the circumstance, you will never truly experience what it is like.
Yeah, and it's such a beautiful experience in hindsight, you know.
Very much
so. It really is.
Well, where can someone buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
MishnaWolf.com, MishnaWolf.com. And just to give you the end of the story, like, I met the love of my life and had a beautiful child and got married again.
Fantastic. See, everything happened for a reason. Congratulations.
I think so. Thank you.
What are your plans for the remainder of the year?
You know, I'm working on another book, and I'm working on an adaptation of this. But other than that, I'm, you know, I'm going to teach my daughter to walk.
That should be wonderful and fun. I'm very sure of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. She actually teaches herself, so I can't take any credit for it.
The key to me now is you got to make sure she say mama instead of dada.
Yeah, I know, I know, I know. But you know what? She's going to say dada first, because I say dada like 40 times a day. There's no way around.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm just like, you know what? It's okay. She can say dada first.
I understand. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Yeah, you know what? I think I do. I think my recipe for living is to try to, like, just rise above it, whatever it is. Even if you get a nosebleed, just try to rise above it. And
very, very interesting.
The high road.
Don't ever give up.
Don't ever give up, and don't let it get you down, because it's not personal.
Very true, because if you take it personally, it'll just drag you down. In the book, you set some pretty defined goals back then.
Yeah.
Do you consider you have accomplished all of them in some ways?
Oh, yeah. You mean wanting to be a great anesthesiologist and go to school in Boston? No, you know what? I didn't accomplish any of those goals. Thank God. I wouldn't be wearing the totally wrongest life for myself if I had accomplished those goals. Instead, I have a life that was completely not of my making, that is completely perfectly suited for me.
Fantastic. I use the term the life that has chosen me. And, you know, we go where it goes.
Yes, that's kind of exactly what happened. You know, it's like, I had really big plans, none of which were right for me.
Well, Mishna, thank you very much for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Gemini Adams. She is a multi-award-winning author and a grief expert. In her new book, Your Legacy of Love, Gemini explains that our real wealth lies not in our financial assets, but our emotional assets. The values, the memories, the lessons, voice, image, wisdom, and affections that we capture and share through a loving legacy. Gemini and I will be discussing her new triple award-winning book, Your Legacy of Love, to help all of us realize this amazing gift. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Twitter.com/FMMK Talk Radio. And Mishna, can you please mention again your website?
Yeah, it's Mishna Wolff, MishnaWolff.com. And also, you know, the book's out in paperback. You can get it on BarnesandNoble.com. You can get it on Amazon.com. You can get it at your local bookstore, I think. The title's I'm Down, a Memoir, because I'm down. Like that, I'm down. So.
It's a wonderful book, and it's a wonderful read, and it gives us a wonderful snapshot of just growing up, and it certainly reminds me about how I grew up in Malaysia. I would certainly recommend it to everyone. It's a wonderful read. Thank you all for listening. Have a great week. Mishna, thank you again, and have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.